Animals can feel fear, of course. But fear for them is a response to an acute and immediate danger, like a predator's teeth or a hunter's bullet. You never find an animal sitting nervous and tense, biting its fingernails in anticipation of some nameless dread which hasn't yet materialized and probably never will. Yet man is often found doing just that. I suppose you could argue that makes men more foolish than the animals are. Indeed, many people have interpreted Jesus to mean precisely that when he told us that we should consider the birds of the air and not worry. But I suspect actually the contrary is the case. People worry not because men are more stupid than animals, but precisely because their intelligence is superior to the animals. It's all tied up with men's special faculty of imagination. Man alone in the animal world can conceive of things not only as they are, but as they might be. On the one hand, that gives him his capacity for humour, for instance. He can recognise the amusing incongruities in situations and laugh at them. But on the other hand, it gives him his capacity for anxiety. He can recognise the unpleasant possibilities in situations and be disturbed by them. So in a sense, it's no good complaining about worry, as if it were an unfair burden placed on our shoulders. No doubt we've all envied the skylark, his carefree song, or wished, like David, that we had the wings of a dove by which to fly away from the stresses of existence. But the fact is, if we couldn't worry about life, neither could we enjoy it half so much. Worry, like guilt, which we were thinking about last week, is a reflection of our human privilege as made in God's image. We're able to feel guilty because we've been given moral responsibility like God. We're able to feel anxiety because we've been given creative imagination like God. It's true that, as Jesus says, birds of the air don't worry. But then birds are psychologically incapable of it. They live by instinct, oblivious to everything but the present instant and what's happening in it. But we human beings think about things, and it's because we think that we worry. Indeed, if you examine carefully what Jesus is saying in that passage, I think you'll discover that he's not advocating that we should take a lesson from the birds and refuse to think about our problems. Rather, he's encouraging us to observe the way that the birds, in spite of their nonchalant, thoughtless approach to life, are nevertheless fed. So it's a lesson in faith, Jesus is teaching, not an exhortation to carelessness. When applied to a human being, careless is a criticism, and rightly so. To have no care is to be frivolous and irresponsible. There's nothing laudable about it. It may be appropriate to birds, but it's not appropriate to us. No, it's part of our human dignity that we can worry about things. Perhaps we would not resent anxiety so much if we understood that better. But having said that, one has to say that even if our capacity for worry is something that marks us out as special in creation, it is nevertheless a great problem for many people, and an increasing one in these days in which we live. More and more people are in fact becoming worried about worry. In July last year, the US Food and Drug Administration ordered that the benzodiazepine drugs, which we know better as the popular tranquilizers Valium and Librium, should carry a warning label stating that they should not be prescribed for anxiety and tension associated with the stress of everyday life. It was a first move toward curbing the present trend of using these tablets as a daily habit. Whether it will succeed or not, I rather doubt. Aldous Huxley prophesied years ago in his book Brave New World that we would all soon be in a permanent state of drug-induced euphoria, and the signs are that Valium may well be one step on the way to that. Anxiety today is responsible for the loss of more man-hours than all the infectious diseases put together. It manifests itself in so many different ways. Sometimes it's very obvious. Some people, for instance, suffer from what doctors call anxiety reactions, whether it be acute attacks of sudden and inexplicable panic, or a more chronic state of permanent apprehension, jumpiness. The physical symptoms are easily recognised: sweating, trembling, paleness of complexion, palpitations of the heart, headache, indigestion, high blood pressure. And where these things continue for a long time, there are secondary effects like ulcers and heart attacks, and very probably a susceptibility to many other conditions. Such anxiety states are incredibly disabling. But they're just the tip of the anxiety iceberg. Beyond these easily identifiable indicators of anxiety, many psychiatrists today believe that occult anxiety is also the underlying cause for the vast majority of neurotic illnesses also. Rather than give way to anxiety, they say, many people erect subconscious defense mechanisms by which to protect or control their feelings. Different people use different kinds of psychological defense, depending largely on what sort of personality type they are. People who are reserved and fastidious, for instance, tend to fall victim to obsessive reactions. They feel compelled to keep washing their hands, perhaps, or something like that. Kleptomania, the compulsion to steal things, belongs to this same category, and there are dozens of other examples. On the other hand, say psychiatrists, some people have what's called a conversion personality. Very suggestible, warm-hearted types, prone to wild swings in mood. Under stress, these, they say, tend to have what's called hysterical reactions. They develop, perhaps, quite undeliberately, symptoms which mimic organic illness. Deafness, blindness, paralysis, pain, fits, practically anything. Then there are some personalities which are prone to develop what are called phobic reactions, irrational fears of heights or spiders or open spaces. In other people, it's fatigue reactions. They feel permanently weary, though there's no physical cause for their exhaustion. Still others have what are called dissociative reactions, like amnesia or sleepwalking. And of course, getting more and more common these days is what psychiatrists call the depressive reactions to anxiety. Commonest, they say, among studious, hard-working, conscientious personalities. This kind of person tends to lapse into an inexplicable mood of melancholy dejection. They don't want to eat, they can't sleep, they just feel depressed. Now, there are countless types of neurotic reaction that have been identified over the years, but whatever particular form of neurosis it may be, there's a general consensus among doctors that they are all symptomatic of unresolved anxiety of some kind. Anxiety that we would rather repress beneath the surface of our minds than admit to. And when you consider that neurotic conditions warranting medical treatment are to be expected sooner or later in one out of every four people, why then it's clear that anxiety is a very, very widespread problem today. Of course, psychiatrists have their treatments for it. Drugs, psychotherapy, group therapy, electric shock treatment, behavioural reconditioning techniques, hypnosis even, new approaches are being developed all the time. And I want to make it clear, as I've tried to do throughout this series of talks, that where a person is seriously disabled by these kinds of neurotic condition, such treatments may well be needed. It's not my intention to knock the psychiatric profession, whose help I've certainly valued on numerous occasions as a pastor. But the fact remains, while psychiatry today can diagnose neurosis and has a limited measure in treatment, limited measure of success in treating them, it has no real answer to the anxiety which psychiatrists themselves identify as the major underlying cause. For as we said earlier, the capacity to worry is built into our human makeup. As our world becomes more and more insecure, with family breakdown and nuclear threat and economic uncertainty, so neurotic illness is going to proliferate. More and more people will be coming back from their GP surgery with the verdict, "The doctor says it's my nerves." More and more bottles of Valium and Librium will be prescribed, whatever government warnings are printed on the outside of them. For so long as man thinks about things, he will worry about things. All psychiatry can do is to help him cope with those worry feelings in the least incapacitating way. But as for curing worry, I'm afraid the answer is no. Anxiety is a condition endemic in the human race, and there's no known cure. Wait a minute, did I say no known cure? No, that's not quite true. There is a cure. Not one you'll discover on the psychiatrist's couch or in the medicine cupboard. It's my task this morning to tell you about it. The remedy is, in fact, all contained in those verses in Philippians that we read earlier. Let me remind you of some of them. From Philippians chapter 4, verse 11. I am not saying this, says Paul, because I am in need, for I have learned to be content, whatever the circumstances. I know what it is to be in need, and I know what it is to have plenty. I have learned the secret of being content in any and every situation, whether well-fed or hungry, whether living in plenty or in want. I can do everything through him who gives me strength. Now, as Paul writes those words, he is sitting in a prison cell, damp, hungry, lonely, bankrupt, with a death sentence hanging over his head. If anybody should have been feeling neurotic, he should. Yet as he sat there, he tells us he was experiencing what countless thousands of people in this anxiety-ridden world are longing to experience and can never find. Contentment. I want you to notice several things about this contentment. First, I want you to notice that it wasn't natural to Paul's personality. He hadn't always known it. He said he had had to learn it. The second thing I want you to notice is that it wasn't dependent in any way on the degree of material prosperity or lack of it that he was enjoying. It wasn't that he had discovered in the austerity of his prison life the ascetic bliss of a simple lifestyle. No, this contentment had been just as relevant to days of affluence as it is to days of deprivation, he says. Content to enjoy plenty, content to suffer need, he says. And the third thing I want you to notice about is it was not in any way self-manufactured. Paul had not discovered within himself by some kind of yoga meditation, some psychic secret of a relaxed mind. No, the power by which he had found contentment in life derived from outside his own human resources. He's quite clear about that. I can do everything, he says, through him who gives me strength. Who is that, you ask? Why, it's Jesus, of course. Jesus had transformed Paul's attitude to life, and in transforming it had delivered him from that burdensome anxiety which tortures so many minds in this world of ours today. What I want to do this morning is simply to identify in this passage three areas of human concern which are potential stress generators, and show how Jesus can change our thinking in regard to them, so ridding us of anxieties that would otherwise fester in our hearts and disturb our peace. In this way, I want us to discover how we can share Paul's testimony of contentment. These three areas of potential stress I want to identify are firstly, our attitude to relationships, secondly, our attitude towards circumstances, and thirdly, our attitude towards what I can only call evil. Let's look at relationships first. In verses 4 and 5. Rejoice in the Lord always. I say it again, rejoice. Let your gentleness be evident to all. The Lord is near. An awful lot of human anxiety derives from our failure to get on with other people amicably. Feelings of jealousy, perhaps. We feel threatened by their gifts. Or of anger, perhaps, we feel hurt by their insensitivity. Of insecurity, perhaps, we feel afraid that they won't accept us. Feelings of neglect, perhaps, we feel indignant that they don't notice us. Oh, we don't admit the presence of such feelings always. We conceal them behind a veil of disinterested bonhomie. But inwardly they are there, gnawing away like psychological gangrene, and they destroy our joy. Whenever that person is around, we feel on edge, nervy. Whenever we think about them, the adrenaline starts to flow and the blood starts to boil. Silently we rehearse the argument we'd love to have with them, the revenge we'd love to wreak on them. We're far too polite to ever actually face the showdown. It's a secret antagonism bottled up within us, usually. Nobody knows about it. But it's nonetheless self-destructive for being thus hidden. Many people are victim to anxiety feelings quite simply because they cannot manage their social life without getting uptight about it in this way. Now, what's the answer to it? Well, Paul's recommendation is quite simply gentleness. Let your gentleness be evident to all, he says. It's possible to experience joy in the Lord, but only if you display gentleness toward everyone. Now, that's a very lovely word, though it's a very difficult one to translate. Perhaps the easiest way to explain it is to see it illustrated in something that Jesus once said. In an occupied country like Palestine, a Roman official or soldier could commandeer anybody to do service for him. There's a good example of it, actually, in the Bible, when Simon Cyrene was commandeered to carry Jesus' cross. This kind of action was bitterly resented by the ordinary people, and though it would be death to show disrespect to a Roman, any Jew so compelled to serve would be inwardly seething throughout the entire exercise. Jesus, though, in the Gospels, advocates a completely different approach. If someone compels you to go 1 mile, he says, go 2. Now that is precisely the sort of attitude which is described by this word gentle. It means generous or easygoing. The gentleman is the man who never nurses a grudge, never adopts an entrenched, obstinate posture, the sort of man who's always willing to conciliate, even at the cost of his own pride. That's the sort of person Christ both wants us to be and enables us to be. Let your gentleness be evident to all, says Paul. It was especially relevant to the Philippians because, as you can see if you look back at verse 2, there were two women in the church, Euodia and Syntyche, who seemed to have been conducting some kind of running feud. I plead with you both, says Paul. Agree with each other in the Lord. Don't tolerate such tensions amongst yourselves. They will rob you of your contentment. Be humble enough to forgive and forget. After all, says Paul, the Lord is near. Once Christ comes into our lives, we do not have any secrets anymore. He's near in location. For by his Spirit he can penetrate our psychological defences and observe exactly what's going on in our subconscious minds. Everything's uncovered and laid bare before his eyes. But more than that, he's near us in time, too. He stands on the threshold of the universe, ready to burst in upon our world. And when that day of judgment comes, nothing is concealed that won't be disclosed. Things whispered in the dark will be shouted from the housetops. That being so, says Paul, get your personal relationships straight. Don't have any of these secret animosities inside you. Bring Jesus into your life, and he will give you a gentleness that will dissolve such anxiety-generating alienations. He will destroy our enemies for us by making them our friends. One thing is sure, so long as we allow our lives to be disturbed by these kinds of personal feud, there can be no contentment for us. That's the first area, then, our social relationships, a possible area of stress which Jesus can help us to come to terms with. The second area Paul talks about is our attitude towards circumstances. Look at verse 6. Do not be anxious about anything, but in everything, by prayer and petition, with thanksgiving, present your requests to God. Here's the second area, then, of potential anxiety. Not other people this time, but other things. The exam we must pass. What will our parents say if we let them down? The debt we've incurred. Where will we hide our faces if we can't afford the repayments? The decision we've got to make. Suppose we make the wrong choice. The future we can't read. What if the worst happened? For the person who's inclined to be morbid, just about every aspect of life is a cause for worry. The answer? The answer is to bring Jesus in on the scene. Consciously do so. This is the privilege of the Christian. And if you do, the peace of God will invade your life, says Paul. There's no peace for the man who allows himself to be buffeted by the tyranny of his circumstances, but the man who's learned to commit his circumstances to a sovereign, wise, and loving Father. He's freed from all such unproductive fretting. There's a poise, a composure, and an unruffled tranquility about him. He keeps his head even if all others are losing theirs. This peace of God, says Paul, guards heart and mind. It provides him with an inner security, surrounding like a fortress his emotional makeup. Says Paul, this peace of God transcends all understanding. What does Paul mean by that? Does he mean God's peace is so mysterious that human reason can never comprehend it? That's true, certainly. Few things move us to worship more than the experience of God's peace. Does he mean that God's peace is so valuable that human knowledge can never rival it? That's true too. It's far more desirable to possess God's peace than have a crystal ball any day. Or does it mean that God's peace is so distinctively divine that human intelligence can never contrive to imitate it? Perhaps that more than anything. Psychiatry can help us cope with our anxiety, but only Jesus can carry our anxieties for us. Cast your care upon him, says Peter. He cares for you. Of course we should be riddled with neurotic fears, until we are humble enough to do that. Our attitude to social relationships, then, that's one thing we've got to get straight with Jesus. Our attitude to circumstances, too. But there's a third area of possible anxiety, and that I've called simply evil. Look at verses 8 and 9. Finally, brothers, whatever is true, whatever is noble, whatever is right, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is admirable, if anything is excellent or praiseworthy, think about such things. Whatever you've learned or received or heard from me or seen in me, put it into practice, and the God of peace will be with you. For some people, anxiety simply hinges around an inability to cope with the problem of evil. Evil in myself, perhaps. Addictions that are compulsive. Habits I can't shake. Temptations that torment me. Guilt is really a very specific form of anxiety. Or it may be evil in the world around. The threat of nuclear war, of economic slump, of burglars in the night, of the terrorist bomb, of cancer. For many sensitive people, the fear of evil is a crippling paralysis that condemns them to a perpetually morbid view both of themselves and of the world around them. It's as if for them the sense of sin and the power of the devil has loomed so large in their vision that it soured their whole perspective on. Now, when Jesus comes into our lives, he brings a remedy for such negative attitudes. How? Why is this, Paul? By providing us with a new thought life. Don't be obsessed with evil. I'm victor over it, he says. Focus your mind instead around wholesome and good things. Think about, well, think with integrity, says Paul. Whatever is true. In a world full of affectation and insincerity, Christian, you search out the genuine, the authentic, the honest things, and meditate on them. Think with seriousness, says Paul, whatever is noble. In a world that is preoccupied with the trivial and the banal, exercise your mind over weighty and important things. Think with objectivity, whatever is right. In a world where judgment is often prejudiced, concentrate on forming impartial opinions. Think with moral conscience, whatever is pure. In a world that delights in the salacious and the depraved, keep the corridors of your mind undefiled. Think with aesthetic sensitivity, whatever is lovely. What a surprising word to include. In a world where art revels in maximizing audience shock and parades all that is ugly and sordid and perverted and boasts that it has been so explicit, you, Christian, you reflect only on what is beautiful. Think with good taste, whatever is admirable. In a world that extols vulgarity, cultivate a refined appreciation of the best things, things that are deserving of admiration, whatever is excellent, whatever is praiseworthy. Think about these things, says Paul. Not that the Christian is a monk who tries to run away psychologically from the reality of evil. No, he is to be a critic, evaluating life, identifying within it the remnants of that wholesomeness which God saw when he first made the world and pronounced it good, disciplining his mind to spend time appreciating those things. A new thought life. That's what Jesus provides. And it's the answer to our unhealthy obsession with evil. But there's something else he provides too. And that is a new guidebook. Look at verse 9 again. Whatever you've learned or received or heard from me or seen in me, put it into practice. Does that sound arrogant of Paul? It shouldn't do. He's simply drawing our attention to the special authority which Jesus gave to his apostles in the first century. The things you've learned from me, that is the teaching of the apostles, as they explained the gospel to us. The things you've received from me, that's the tradition of the apostles, the things they passed on from the primitive account of the life and ministry of Jesus. The things you've heard from me, that is the message of the apostles, as it came to the church, on occasion second-hand, via Luke or Mark. And the things you've seen in me, the examples of the apostles, as those who knew them witnessed to the quality of their lives. What's Paul talking about here? Well, as far as we're concerned, he's talking about the New Testament. That's the inspired record of what the church learned from the apostles, received from the apostles, heard from the apostles, and saw in the apostles. When Paul says, whatever you've gathered from all these sources, put it into practice, he's simply saying to us, read your Bible and live by it. For the Bible is not a morbid book. It's not a book depressingly obsessed with sin. It's a book radiating with hope and faith. So study it, absorb it, do as it says, and you'll find your life beginning to radiate with hope and faith too. A new thought life? A new guidebook. Use them, says Paul, and the God of peace will be with you. That's not just pious sentiment. For Paul, this is solid, practical experience. He had found Jesus himself and discovered a changed attitude to relationships, a changed attitude to circumstances, a changed attitude to evil. And Paul, speaking to us across the centuries, gives us his testimony I have learned, he says, the secret of being content. I can do all things through him who gives me strength. Are there not those of us here for whom anxiety is a problem? Well, you won't find the remedy for it either within your own personality or in man-made psychiatric therapies. But Jesus is still amongst us this morning. Come to me, he says, you're worn out and burdened, and I will give you rest. He can, you know. Paul found it so, and many of us here this morning can endorse his testimony. Bring Jesus into your life, and the God of peace will be with you too.